Okay, I am recording. This is Michelle DeMeo. I'm here with my colleague David Caruso, and we are in La Jolla, California on June 3rd, 2024, with Charles Cochran. Charlie, could we begin by asking you to tell us some basic information about where you were born and when?
Born in Berkeley, California, in 1930.
Okay, and who were your parents?
They were Adelaide and Eric Cochran. He came over from England as a young child and lived in Fresno, California, and then went to the University of California in Berkeley. And that's where he met my mother.
Why did your father come from England to the United States?
His family had moved over.
Okay. And did you have other siblings as well?
He had three brothers.
Okay. And your mother?
My mother had six siblings.
Oh, goodness,
She
yeah.
was the eldest of all of them.
And they're both from where in England?
My father was from Bristol.
You mentioned that Berkeley is where your parents met. Was your mother attending college as well?
She was also at the University of California, and that's where she met my father.
And what were your parents studying in college?
Just a variety of things. I don't think anything in any major in particular. But he went on in 1929 and opened a business of investing for personnel for clients
Okay.
in 1929, which was about a year before the Depression occurred.
Gosh, yeah. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, stories you may have heard about the
Oh, yeah,
struggles?
well, he had terrible struggles. And in fact, at one point he was having such trouble he had to move down to Mexico
Oh, wow.
for about 6 months to a year and then come back because he just had to get away from it all.
Was there a business reason in Mexico, or it was just
No,
too?
just
Okay.
had to escape.
Got it. Yeah.
But he was certainly a good father to have, and I had a good mother. We had a very close family.
Did you have brothers and sisters as
Yes, I
well?
had an elder brother.
Okay. What's the age difference?
Two years.
And you mostly grew up in Berkeley then?
Yes.
Until what age?
Till I was 19, and then I went
Okay.
to college in the East. My brother had gone also at about the same age to Yale.
Okay. What kind of schools did you attend when you were a child before you moved to Rochester?
Just high school.
Was it a public
Yeah,
or
Berkeley High School,
private?
public high
Berkeley,
school.
Berkeley Public, okay. And could you tell us a little bit more about that experience? Did you enjoy it? Were you active with sports? Were you advanced in your classes? Any favorite classes?
Well, I can tell you about the sports. I like to play tennis. I was
Yeah.
on the tennis team. And we lived right near the Berkeley Tennis Club, so I could spend time there playing with others and taking lessons and that sort of thing. But Berkeley High was Berkeley High School that both my brother and I attended. It was a good high school, and it trained kids to go on to college.
So you, most of your friends also went to college.
Yes.
Yeah. And at that time, did you know what you wanted to pursue, or it was more general education? You just knew you wanted to go to college, or did you have a sense of your career path?
No, I just to go on to college, and but it was in college I decided to go into the field of medicine.
Dave, do you want to ask any follow-ups on that before we talk about?
Sure. So can you just tell me a little bit more what it was like growing up in Berkeley during the Depression? I'm always curious to know how families fared. You mentioned that your father had this business. It didn't go well. He went to Mexico for several months. Did you go with him? Did you stay at home? If you were home, how was your family bringing the money? I just want to know a little bit more about those early years.
No, both my brother and I stayed at home, and my father wanted my mother to go with him, but she would not leave her children. But we stayed there, and I must say that I was unaware of many of the things that was happening because I was that young. And but I know that my parents would have somebody come and help in the house, and they had to select people who were not in trouble because of the Depression. And we had good people that came, and I remember some of them.
Did your mother work as well?
No, she did not. In those days, the mothers did not work. They stayed at home and to take care of the children. So my mother was with us all the time. And my father would come home.
Sorry,
and
go ahead.
We'd take... He was particularly good about taking us up into the mountains as a father. And my mother would come along, and we would go up and spend a week or a month, actually, in the Sierras. And then as time went on, he would take my brother and me up into the Sierra, and we would go in on horseback into the upper regions. And that's something that stayed with me, so that when I came back after finishing medical school and going into research, I would take members of my laboratory up there who wanted to go. Well, they all wanted to go. And so we had to have 25 kids going up. We would drive up and to the eastern side of the Sierra and go in, I would rent horses for people to ride in if they wanted to. And I always walked in, go over a pass, down the other side, and spend about 5 or 6 days there, just going fishing and just enjoying the beauty of the Sierra. And then we'd all come back. I remember I would have meetings every now and then of getting them all together. And one of them said at one of our meetings that he thought that the trips into the Sierra was the best part of his education.
When you were taking these trips, were you living off the land completely?
Into the Sierra? Yes. We'd have to take all the food in with us because we'd go into the back country and there's nobody there. Mm-hmm. There would be just lakes and rivers and that sort of thing.
So during these trips, did your father try to... So when I was growing up, I was a Boy Scout, and so used to go on camping trips. That's where I learned how to start fires using sticks. That's where I learned how to, chop wood, things like that. Were you doing those things, those types of things on the trips as well?
Or
was
sure.
It just horseback riding, hiking, that
no,
sort of stuff?
When we were there, we had to make fires cook food and that sort of thing. So my knowledge that I got from my father paid off. I could use that to do what was necessary, and then the people in the camp all got used to doing that too.
After the time that your father was in Mexico, when he came back to the United States, did he go back to his previous business or did he launch a new endeavor?
Back to his previous business and formed a group. The three of them worked together. It was called Cochran, Meehan, and Eyre. And they would, my father spent most of the time, Ayer was a very wealthy guy and didn't do much at all. But my father built the clients up, and he had many of them who appreciated what he could do and did do for them.
What industry were his clientele in?
I really cannot tell you. Okay. They were from all sorts of things. They're like in Piedmont, California, they were wealthy people and who needed to get their money invested for them, which is what he did.
Sure, yeah.
I met some interesting people, his clients.
Which ones? Do you want to talk about any?
Well, I just met them, and it was fun to meet them and talk to them and get along.
Maybe that was some form of inspiration for you, perhaps, in your career long term, do you think?
That's a good point, and I think it probably was a good an inspiration. Number one, how to treat the clients.
From those early years, so you went hiking the Sierras, you were at home living in Berkeley. What was the area like? Were you and your brother the only kids around? Were there other kids in the neighborhood that you went out to play with?
No, we had many friends there. And in fact, I started playing tennis as an 11-year-old. And would go to the Berkeley Tennis Club and play there with other kids. And we became very good friends as children, playing tennis and trying to beat each other and going to school at the same time. I would go to, in the middle school, as soon as the bell rang, I'd be headed for the tennis club and to play tennis with other guys. And that worked out fine until I got a C in Latin. Mm-hmm. My mother said, "You're coming home after school." So I had to come home and not play tennis. But I played tennis really for the rest of my life until just recently. Oh. And now too weak to hit the ball and run and that sort of thing.
So in addition to tennis, what other things outside of school were you doing? Let's say in the evenings, were you an avid reader? Did you and your brother play stickball in the street? What were some of the other activities you engaged with as a young child?
I think reading and we would have groups of kids that would get together and do various things, which was really a pleasure.
Were you close with your brother? I'm sorry. Were you close with your brother?
Oh, yes.
Because 2 years difference,
yes.
So, yeah.
In fact, he went to Yale, and then I went to Rochester in upstate New York. When I used to go, if I had a few extra days, I'd go take the train down to and go get to New Haven through New York and spend time with him and his friends. They all lived on the campus at Yale, and so I got to meet them and made some very close friends, which was a pleasure. Oh, yes. Something else I did as a youngster was to collect butterflies. And I had a butterfly net, and I would use chloroform in a bottle to be able to take the butterflies. And I made collections of them and put them in a container that my father got and provided. So it was a pleasure. And then I learned the names of all the butterflies, which of course I've forgotten, except for monarchs and swallowtails.
How old were you when you were doing that?
I was in the lower middle school, okay. So I suppose I was about 12, mm-hmm. starting to do that. And I did it through high school because, you know, going out into fields where there are flowers with a butterfly net and catching them, as you're in the fields and you're enjoying the flowers, you're enjoying the whole thing, as well as catching the butterflies. And I would only catch butterflies after that I didn't have.
Okay. How big was your collection?
I think there were about 35 different species of butterflies. And the other thing is growing orchids. My father took my brother, and then when he graduated from high school, and then when I did, he took me too. But when he took him east to school, he had a orchid house built for me, which was it was about 12 feet by 12 feet a square, and all covered and connected. And so I started getting orchid plants, and I went and found a producer of orchids in Berkeley, and I could get little beginning orchid plants from him and then grow them up. And so it was a pleasure to see the orchids really develop and grow. And I think the whole family did, because they could cut the orchids and take them in the house and as flowers in the house. That was one of the really pleasurable things. Of course, when I graduated from high school, he also took me to the East, and we went through, well, first of all, to Rochester to see the various things that were there, and then to Boston, down to New York, and see the historical things in all of that area. So my father did a lot for both my brother and me, getting us going. As did my mother. She was a marvelous person who, during the Depression, people would come on to the front door and knock on it who were in hunger. And she would say, of course, just go around the back and sit on the stairs there, and she would bring them out a meal to eat. And then they would eat that meal and thank her and leave. But this was the Depression.
Oh my goodness.
And I remember those conditions. It was just a horrible time.
In the evenings when you were young and your family was home, did you all eat dinner together?
Oh, we did. Always ate dinner. And my mother always cooked it.
Mm. And over dinner, what did your family talk about? Were there discussions of politics or religion? Was it chatting with the kids about what they learned at school? What did your family discuss while they were having your meals?
Sort of things, what happened to the kids during the day at school and other things. And we would get into laughter and had good times together. And those times were a real pleasure.
As you were getting older, let's say sort of mid-1930s, later 1930s, let me ask this first. Did your father still have family in England?
No, they were all in this country and in different parts. A couple of them stayed in Fresno and one was down in Los Angeles. And he knew them and stayed in contact.
Because what I was going to ask was, you know, as we get into the late 1930s, Germany, rise of Hitler, war was kind of going to be happening, starting. So I didn't know if you had family in England still that was impacted, and whether or not your family discussed that level of politics or, you know, the beginnings of what came to be World War II.
No, the family had all come out, so they were not there, and that was, I'm sure, a relief to all of them, because there was the possibility the Germans, as you know, would cross the English Channel and come into England to try to capture England. So that was a good thing that we did, or they did what they did, namely leave England.
Do you remember hearing anyone talking about that in your household, the war coming, or how it was impacting your family?
Yeah, they talked about it all the time.
Yeah.
My father, in fact, went back to New York to try to see if he could help by, we started flying things over to England to help them, food and all sorts of things, and maybe even munitions. And he wanted to fly with them to help take things to England since he came from there. Mm. But he couldn't, and he had to get back on the train and come back to Berkeley.
And what was it like once the U.S. declared war in the 1940s? Did things change for you at all around your home?
They sure did. There was a concern that Monica, there's a helmet on the screen just came on.
Oh. Michelle needs to look at that. Michelle.
Oh.
Charlie, that's really interesting, too. December 7th, when you were on the bay and a little kid.
Yeah. Monica just reminded me that you asked about the beginning of the war. We were fishing with a friend of my family, who took us over to shallow areas in San Francisco and that go up like little rivers into the backcountry. But those were good places to fish that he knew about. So as a little kid, he took me over along with my father, and we fished during the day. And that was December 7th. And we came back, and he had been in charge of a submarine in World War I, and so he knew the military. He came back, we came back home, and we let him out of the car, and his wife came screaming out to say that the Japanese had just attacked Pearl Harbor. And that started then a whole series of things. We had no way of keeping the Japanese away from us. And they could have come in and bombed our San Francisco Bay Area. So we had we had to drop our lights at night in the houses, which we all did, and then constantly watching to see if airplanes came in from the west that would be bombing. And that went on for quite a while until we started building up the ability to keep them from attacking very, very quickly. But I say very quickly, and yet it took some time to do that while we were working quickly, or the government was working quickly with the practically no military that we had.
Yeah.
So that was, those were unique times that I will never come back.
Did you have folks close to you who were joined the military?
Yes, and we had a guy who was Philippines who worked in our house and helped with the dishes and take care of things. And he went into the service, and so we put in those days, if you had somebody who went into the service, you'd put a star on your window, a blue star. If he got killed, you'd turn it to a gold star. And we had a blue star for this guy, Marciano, when he went into the military.
Did he return to your house after the war?
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
What else do you remember kind of changing around that time for you? Did things at school change? Were you, going through air raid drills? Was the education changing? What was it like being a young student at that period of time?
Well, I think there was just a constant awareness of of the war, and every now and then there would be concern that an airplane was coming in to drop bombs, and so the air raid sirens would go off all over town. And those were scary because you didn't know whether or not there'd be a bomber coming in. Of course, you were supposed to go down into in the basement of the schools to avoid being killed by the bombs. So that kind of scariness did take place.
While you were in class and you weren't going into these drills or there weren't sirens going off, did the education that you received change at all? Were teachers teaching you about the war, or was it just like your standard curriculum
curriculum? Some of the teachers had gone to be in the service, so we were down some of that. Also, if there was a potential bombing coming in the school, we'd all go running out the doors and down for protection, get out of the classroom. Interesting days, scary days, as you can see.
While you were in school, were there classes that you liked more than others? Were you a history buff, math person, or were you very comfortable with all the different things that you were learning?
Science. I liked the various courses that they offered in various aspects of the scientific area, and those were good.
Could you tell us more about your science education? Did you have a lab at school? Did you have...
No, it was strictly classes.
Just classes.
And we would learn the class and then take tests. This was Berkeley High School. And they did have a variety of scientific courses to take. But I also liked the history courses. Those were good. My brother loved history, and that's what he went into. When he went to Yale, he majored in history. So with him loving history, I liked it too.
And so as you're progressing through high school, you're involved in tennis. I forget if you mentioned this was middle school or high school. You weren't performing as well as you should have been in Latin, so you were pulled away from tennis for a little bit. But were there other activities that you enjoyed participating in during middle school, during high school, performing in school musicals or plays? Were you part of any other clubs or have other activities that you engage with? Like, did you have a part-time job? What else was going on for you during your high school years?
Well, there was a club called Unoia, E-U-N-O-I-A. And that was a group from each class that we had about, I suppose, 30 in the entire group, but from 9th through 12th grade. And these were particularly good people, and coming in the ninth grade, you were exposed to those in the 12th grade who would talk about things that they like to do and that you might like to do. So you learn what's good in the coming years, and it helps you decide what to do and what courses to take. So that was... My brother was in that same group 2 years ahead of me. So, that was a good thing to do. It's just a shame that there weren't more students in these groups, especially kids who did not have much money. And I remember, or black kids, and I remember it when I was in my junior year there, about 11th grade, trying to convince people in the club, the Anoia Club, to taken a black boy that I knew and became friendly with and have him come into the club, but they wouldn't do it. And that made me angry. I'm always believing in inclusion and that people should not be considered different.
So the Anoia Club had boys and girls,
no, but
it was just boys, and it was primarily white boys?
Exactly.
Exclusively white. Yeah, okay.
And then there were girls' clubs, too. Mm. So the boys' clubs and the girls' clubs used to have times together.
Dave was asking about your high school more generally, the demographic makeup. Did you have black Latino students?
Oh, there were some blacks. Berkeley had on the west side next to the bay were mostly people without much funds, low income, were staying, and these generally were people of color. In those days, and I would do everything I could to turn it around, and still do.
So when you were entering high school, your brother was already a couple of years in. You mentioned that he went to Yale, you went to Rochester. During high school years, did your family start talking about college?
Yes.
Opportunities, expectations. Since you did wind up both going to the East Coast, was that intentional on your family's part or just happenstance?
With my brother, it was happenstance. And since he went East, I thought it would be great for me to do too. And that's why I applied to the University of Rochester.
Had you been out East already?
Yes, No, I hadn't been East until I graduated from high school. Then my father took me on the train to Chicago and then on to the East Coast, which was just delightful. A real eye-opener.
How so?
Yeah, well, I got to see things in Boston and New York and see what it's like there with the high buildings It was and the big parks like Central Park, which we walked through, and then the Metropolitan Museum of Art. As a youngster, I hadn't seen anything like that.
Did you visit your brother at Yale?
Yes, I'd go down, as I mentioned, when I had an extra day, like a three-day weekend. I would take the train down to New York and then up to New Haven. And that's when I would see him, but I'd really spend most of my time with his pals.
And did you, when you settled on the Rochester, could you tell us more about that? Were there other universities you were considering? Did you consider Yale as well, or you wanted to do something different? Did you have a clue what career path you wanted yet?
Well, I liked science, and I thought maybe medicine would be a good thing to do. And they had, I could take courses there, either at Yale or in Rochester. But I thought it would be good to go to a new university, and one that not many people knew about. So that was Rochester.
So that begs the question, how did you know about Rochester?
I had a friend who had gone there and liked it a lot. So, of course, I was making the decision without much knowledge about it, the school, and how good it was, or myself and how good I was. So I... and I wouldn't be getting a C in Latin, hopefully. So at any rate, I went off to the university there and then stayed on to the medical school Because the medical school was really good.
What was Rochester as a city like?
It was, you know, that was Eastman Kodak that put lots of money into it. So they also built the campus, the undergraduate campus, and put all the money into the buildings that went there. And that's why, and a lot of it was they built for science. But that, with Eastman Kodak and all the good things that there were, there was a big boulevard that had all these wealthy people living on it, who were working at Eastman Kodak. And, you know, you see those things and it's kind of a stimulant to them, and others don't like it, but I like it. And I met some of the people who lived there while I was in college.
When you matriculated to the university, you mentioned that your father took you on this trip visiting various sites on the East Coast. Once you were left at the university and he headed home, what was it like transitioning into college for you? Did you struggle at all with the distance away that you were from Berkeley when winter hit? Was that a bit of a surprise for you? What was it like becoming a college student living kind of on your own and being in this northeastern environment?
I loved it. And when we'd have a snowstorm, I loved that. I just couldn't stop looking at the snow outside the windows or walking around in it or making snowballs, which I'd never considered doing. And we would have snowball fights, the other kids. And I joined a fraternity there, Delta Kappa Epsilon, which happened to be the same fraternity my father was in at the University of California, Berkeley. And I joined that in the end of my freshman year. And so, again, a series of good friends that were there. And then we had a reunion, a 50-year reunion, and Monica went back with me and saw the fraternity house and a bunch of the people who were there, and saw Coakdale's pee in his pants. He was a football player who was a tremendous football player, but he got boomed in the head, and at one point he was unconscious, and that kind of damage had its effect for later life. And we saw that in him that time at the 50th anniversary. He was unable to talk much with people, and he peed in his pants. That's an evidence of damage that can occur as a young person. That's why I learned later that high school kids should not play football, because they are especially damaged and subject to trauma. They still do play high school football, and I know everybody comes to see that, but from it is going to come damaged heads.
Did you live in a fraternity house from your last 4 years, sophomore, junior, senior year?
Sophomore, junior, we had to live in the dorms as freshmen, and I did that, and then moved after I think it was the sophomore year that I moved into the, it could have been the junior year, moved into the fraternity. And there we, you know, if you're rooming with a certain person, you get to know them really well. And I did. I lived, roomed with a guy named Binkmeyer, and then both of us went on to medical school. And I went really to the University of Rochester because the dean of it was a man named George Whipple. And he'd been in San Francisco, but he did not want to go back and start a medical school until they really got after him some of the senior people from Kodak and so forth got him to start a medical school, because with a medical school it would add so much to the city of Rochester, and it did. Even we had classes of about 70 students per class, all men, and it wasn't until my third year that they allowed two women to come in to the class.
When did the school start?
Now it's 50-50.
Okay. When did the school start, the medical school at Rochester?
What was Whipple's age that he's
working on? You said Whipple was pressured by Kodak to create this school in Rochester and bring the money. When was that?
Oh, I think probably about 10 years before I went to the school. So about 1940-something.
So you're one of the earlier cohorts then, when you went there for medical school in 1950, 51?
51.
Yeah.
Well, it was well developed, and they had a marvelous faculty, and caring for patients and so forth was just well developed, because they brought in people from all of the medical schools around to be there. The other professors loved coming there to be the professor there.
Can you tell me a little bit, you had this potential interest in medicine. When you started your freshman year, what courses were you taking?
Took anatomy and biochemistry. We had just a few, and then we would switch the next year. The anatomy lasted for a year, and so we learned all the anatomy of the body by dissecting a human body, and then taking biochemistry at the same time. And what the chemistry
was. Was this as an undergraduate or in medical school?
I'm sorry, in medical school.
So I was wondering what classes you were taking when you entered as an undergraduate. Since you had the interest in medicine, was there a curriculum that was focused on people who might pursue medicine as a degree, or was it more of a liberal arts education?
It was a combination of the two, but there were scientific classes that I could take that were like what was called chordate anatomy, which is the anatomy of animals that have spinal columns. And we did that course in chordate anatomy. Also, the chemistry courses were related to there were biology courses as well, and then chemistry courses that related to the chemistry of the body. So those were eye openers to go into medical school.
Was your first?
Go ahead, Michelle.
I was just going to ask about your education. Was your undergrad education your first time working in a laboratory setting, or did you have to wait till you got to medical school?
We did laboratory work in the chemistry courses, and in biology. But it really came to life in medical school.
What sort of experiments were you performing in those laboratory classes?
Putting together chemicals that would then produce something that we knew existed, but it was to show us how that final product was made. And, I can't remember much more than that to answer your question.
Sure. In addition to joining a fraternity, were there other activities that you were doing in addition to taking your classes?
I was on the tennis team.
So there was an official tennis team at the university?
Oh, yes. And we we would take on tennis teams from other universities, too. So I got to meet a bunch of young people from other schools and get to know them, which was a pleasure, even though I tried to beat them on the tennis court.
And if what I read is correct, you played in the number one position for three straight years from your sophomore to your senior year?
It was really my sophomore, junior, and senior year that happened. And what I really learned was the courts that we had there were asphalt, so they weren't smooth cement. And when I got into playing on the number one court, there was a fence right next to it that had rose bushes on it. So I learned to serve if I throw the ball behind me and hit it, so the ball was going like this, would hit the court and go right at the rose bush, and in order for my opponent to get it, he'd go right into the rose bush. He'd be pulling this.
And had you ever considered potentially pursuing tennis professionally?
Not really, because I wanted to go into medicine, and tennis was something that was on the side, and it was a real pleasure. In medical school, in the winter, we couldn't play because there was snow all over the surface. But I learned to play squash, which was an indoor game, and we could play that, and that was a different kind of game and so forth, but similar with a racket and balls and learning to hit the ball. So that was good. You know, when you're going to school full-time and you're taking lots of courses and then you're going to be working all night on the homework, getting out of class and then getting some exercise, and like playing squash, was a real pleasure.
So, as you're progressing through your undergraduate education, let me ask you this. How many courses were you taking per semester?
About five courses per semester in various areas. From I took courses in German, I took courses in science, and then courses in biology, and courses in history. I took them all.
Okay. Just a quick question, since this is also after the GI Bill, were there any World War II vets in your class?
There were in medical school.
Okay. All right, but not an undergraduate. At the end of your freshman year, did you travel home for the summer, or did you stay in Rochester?
No, I came home for the summer.
And during that summertime period, what were you doing when you were home? Was it just a period of time to relax? Did you get a summer job?
Yeah, I'd get a summer job. Usually over in San Francisco, and I'd take the train over. And my father knew various companies that were involved in doing work to help, work investment business. And so I could get a job in one of those because they knew my father, and that got me. But it was, then I'd be over in San Francisco and I could get to walk around during lunchtime and see things and learn more and more about San Francisco, which was good.
And so then, was this the same for your sophomore and junior years, where you returned home during the summer, took a job?
Yeah.
So, when you started to think about medical schools, were you already set on applying to the University of Rochester, or were you going to use this as an opportunity to maybe explore a different portion of the country and education?
I wanted to go straight into George Whipple's school.
And in fact, so did Rochester have a program where it was sort of an easy path for undergraduates to go into the medical school there?
No,
or was it a
no.
traditional application process and you had to be accepted?
The undergraduate school was strictly separate. And each course was, nobody talked about going to the University of Rochester School of Medicine.
Hmm. So were you one of the only ones in your cohort that went to Whipple's school?
Well, my roommate, Dick
McMeyer,
he went to those. There were several who went on to the university, to the medical school.
And the rest of your colleagues, or your student mates, when you went to graduate school then were very different, it sounds like. You had a few people you knew, but did you say your class was about 75 or so?
In medical school? 70.
And a lot of people from different areas that you did not go to undergraduate.
From all over.
Right. Was it international as well, or just national?
No, just national.
Yeah. Did you continue to live on campus in a...
Always. No, not in medical school.
Okay.
In medical school, we had to live in the neighborhood, so...
Okay.
And it was easy to find places to live.
Did you have your own place, or did you roommate with your old friends?
Well, we had three of us in the house that we lived in.
All medical students?
Yes.
Yep.
And different years.
Oh, okay. So what was it like going from undergraduate education to medical school? Was it more coursework? Was it longer days? Tell us a little bit about how the education system started to change for you.
It was pretty much the same quality. But everything we were doing in medical school involved things we needed to learn and keep in our brains. So in order to go into medicine, and that was quite different. And we were all together, I mean, the whole gang, as opposed to undergraduate, where people were going to be doing different things. But a very high quality of classmates in medical school.
What about the professors? High quality?
Oh, yes.
Who were some of your favorites that you worked with in medical school?
In the professors or the courses?
Both, yeah.
Certainly pathology was one. And...
what did you like about pathology?
Teachers, the professors were very high rate and worked very carefully with the students. What we were learning was everything about the human body and what happens when you get diseases, what it does to the various parts of the body. So I was learning a lot about what we would need to know in the coming years, not just a segment, like being for pediatric or gynecology and so forth, which is a part of medicine that you're learning. This was everything.
You mentioned that your first year was a year of anatomy. And what other courses were you taking?
I have to think back. I guess I needed a course in memory.
You mentioned biochemistry.
Yeah, biochemistry. It's difficult for me to recall the exact courses.
Sure.
And as you were, so when you came into medical school, you wanted to be a physician. Did you have any sense of what you might want to, or if you wanted to specialize in medicine, were you looking to be a general practitioner? Were you waiting to get through medical school to figure out what you might want to specialize in? You know, what was it like? What were your initial ideas about what your future profession was going to be once you became a physician?
That's a good question and an important one for me, because I wanted to go into internal medicine like a general practitioner, because you're seeing all the different kinds of things that adversely affect human beings. So there was a choice of classes that you could take in the third and fourth years, and I did those that would help me get into internal medicine.
I wonder, did that spark maybe that interest in pathology and enjoying those classes? Was that a natural extension from that?
Just a natural change.
Yeah. So what kinds of third and fourth year courses did you have to take to get into internal medicine?
I'll have to take that course in memory again.
That's fine.
But I just don't remember the courses. We took courses in for gastroenterology and cardiology and neurology.
Yeah, so really a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
But go ahead, sorry.
The teachers we had were specialized in those areas.
So what happened that you changed your mind about going into internal medicine?
And going into science?
You had planned to go into internal medicine, but then you didn't. So what happened to change your mind?
I left medical school with the idea that I would go into internal medicine, and patients had problems that of which there was no real answer, and I thought, gosh, maybe they are they have immunologic reactions to themselves, autoimmunity that is causing these problems, loss of vision, loss of hearing, and that sort of thing. So I decided to, when I left the medical school, to go into learning immunology, and I looked around the country to find places where it was done, and there was really only one place that had anything serious in immunology, and that was a terrible university, third-rate university medical school, which was the University of Pittsburgh. But there were five young people, average, I think I've written this, average age was 29, and they were a Department of Immunology, and so I went there. And,
so you finished medical school in, was it 55? With a medical degree, right?
Yes.
And then you were looking, and then you went to the University of Pittsburgh. Was this like a postdoc, or?
Yeah.
It was, okay. And that was 56, right?
Yes.
Okay. So you go, yeah, so tell us a bit about this then, this experience. You're at Pittsburgh now. How different is this from Rochester? What are the classes like, the campus, the opportunities? Tell us a little
bit
about
your experience. Well, I didn't. When I went there, I didn't have a job. I didn't have a position in the university, so I could just do research. And what I did was to start doing work in the laboratory that was similar to some of the others, and this was doing antigens and antibodies, and then after a year doing that, the government established the National Institutes of Health, and they would give funds to do research based upon an application he had sent them. So amongst the others, I was one who also sent an application to get funds for the things I was doing with antigens and antibodies, and I got a grant, and so that paid my salary and for all the things I needed in the laboratory, even though I was getting them from the head of the institution where I went, the head of the department.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm wondering. You didn't have a job. You were just doing research. Did you have a professor who said you could join his research group?
Oh, yes, yes.
Who was that?
Frank Dixon.
Okay. And how did you know Frank Dixon?
Well, this was the group of five that I visited when I went around trying to find some areas doing immunology.
And he said, if you come here, you can use my lab, work with me. And
well, he had several labs that were there. And so I got to use one lab. And I didn't. After about 6 months, I saw areas that I would like to work in, and they would require learning how to do things that the others weren't doing. One of them was using this fluorescent antibodies, and you take an antibody molecule and tag it with a fluorescent substance. So if you look at it under ultraviolet light on a microscope, you can see where that protein was. And so I started doing that, and the one who invented that system of fluorescent antibodies was a man named Albert Koons from Boston, from Harvard, and I got to know him. And I was the only one in the lab of the various people using the fluorescent antibody to look at things, and I did it to the various tests that I was doing in experimental animals.
Mm-hmm. Was this is the work that was supported by the NIH?
Yes.
And who else was working with you on that project? Dixon?
Well, no, I'd be working on it alone.
Was your own, okay?
Because I had my own grant. Mm-hmm. But the others in the group were a guy named William Weigel and Joe Vasquez. A young fellow named Barry Pierce from Canada.
And what were their roles? Could you tell us a little bit about what...
They were doing completely different.
They were?
Yeah.
Okay.
And one named Joe Feldman. And then Frank Dixon was the chairman of the department. Mm-hmm. And after... Well, one of the years... I had permission to take it to move to a different place to learn from different scientists new things that I then could apply to my own research. And so I looked around and I decided to go to the Pasteur Institute.
Oh, right.
L'Institut Pasteur à Paris. Mm-hmm. And so I had to learn French to go there. And I took courses at one of these schools that teach foreign languages and for 6 months. And I went over to Paris and I didn't understand one word anybody said. But I, out at the end, when I got to Institut Pasteur, I would speak English. They all spoke English. And then when I got so I could speak a little more French than they spoke English, we switched over entirely. And that was really good. And since I had an NIH grant and we were and had been doing science for quite a while before, I actually knew more science than they did.
Well, how long were you on the NIH grant for in Pittsburgh? 1 year, 2 years?
2 years.
Okay. And then did you have to publish anything at the end of that time?
Didn't have to, but I did.
What did you? What was that publication?
Well, it was about antigen antibody complexes. And the first ones were with Bill Weigel. I have them all in the other room there.
And is, then, is that your first publication?
Yeah.
1957, I think?
Yeah. And then I learned that you should always have the chairman of the department on, too, so we put Frank Dixon's name on as well.
I see, yeah, but he wasn't actively involved, but you have to do that right.
But over at Paris, I then got so I spoke more French than they did English, and we speak entirely French. And in fact, I was asked to give lectures on my work there at the Pasteur and then down in Lyon. And that was a real pleasure to give lectures in French.
So this was 1959, I think. You spent 2 years in Pittsburgh. You've got your first publication, and then you decided to go to Paris, the Pasteur Institute. Did you know someone there already?
No. No. And they were all new and just delightful people. And one of the things we did was they'd have... This is a joke. Friday afternoons, we'd all have a cup of tea together in the director's, the head of a guy named Pierre Gravard, in his secretary's office, and we would all go in and talk with each other, which was a real pleasure. And so, then every now and then somebody would tell a funny story. And one day he told a funny story, and I understood one side of the meaning, which was not terribly funny, but they were all laughing off their heads at what he had said. And so it was a naughty side that I did.
Sure.
So when everybody left, the secretary came over and whispered in my ear what the naughty side was.
Nice. That is one of those struggles, right? You can learn enough professionally to get by in the lab, but it is those moments that happen at tea or at the bar afterwards that, you know, when you start to really forge friendships with people, and I could imagine the language is a bit of a difficulty there for you.
So that was a great year, being over there and then learning what France was like and meeting French people and going out to the Louvre. And it's not just science, it was being in the art world as well.
So your 1 year that you were there, could you tell me who you worked with in the end? What department were you at?
Had good people there, but they just weren't doing much science at all because they didn't have NIH grants.
Sure.
And they were just trying, that's why they thought what I was doing was so important.
Dave, I don't know if you want to jump in.
Yeah, I mean, one question that I have is, you know, we asked you about college experiences and labs. I know that in medical school you were taking part in certain types of labs, but you weren't trained as a traditional scientist, right? And I'm wondering, when you started doing research, how did you know what you should be doing in order to undertake that research? Had you ever worked with doing experiments in living animals, with extracting samples, with analyzing data, with, I don't even know what equipment was available to you in the lab? Were you familiar with that equipment? Like, how did you learn how to be not just a physician, but a scientist who was doing medical research?
Well, that's when I left medical school after graduation and went down to Pittsburgh, and they were all doing science there, and nothing but science in that group. And so I really learned how to put things together there with them.
So you were collaborating with them to figure out how to construct the experiments and how to run them?
Really, with a guy named one of them, Bill Weigel. And then I picked up things on my own after I got basic things together. And one was how to work with animals, if we were going to do studies on animals. And so I picked that up there as well.
And when you were undertaking this research, right, you'd mentioned that you had developed an interest in the body's responses. Were you thinking, you know, in addition to doing research, I still want to be a physician? Or were you now moving in a direction where it was like, I'm doing research, not necessarily so that way I can see patients, but because I'm interested in medical research?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Yeah. I got so interested in the science that I couldn't get away from it. And everything is new. And when you get a new one, then you realize there's something even beyond that that you can get into. And that's what just kept me going. The other thing was that in science, especially after we moved out to the West Coast, I could have postdoctoral fellows come and join me. And we can get out of that in a minute. But that everything just builds on itself.
And when you were doing the scientific work, were you aware of any organizations out there with people who are doing things similar to you? I know eventually you join a lot of like societies, organizations that focus on various aspects of science, but were you aware of those organizations existing? Were you aware of other physician researchers who were, who maybe had a PhD in addition to their MD? Like, did you have any knowledge of who was out there?
Yeah, it was easy to do that because you go to meetings and people would be presenting their scientific work. And you'd go to the ones that are similar to your own, then you get to meet those other scientists who are doing similar but different work from your own, so that you could talk with them about how you're both going from that point on. So that really spread me out.
How did you find out about those meetings? Was it from colleagues?
Oh, no, they're big meetings that we'd all go to. They're put on every year and by organization, the same organization. And so we would all go to the meeting and spend 4 or 5 nights there staying and going to the meetings during the day. And then we'd really get to know the other ones who were working in similar areas, if not the same as our own. And you get to really get to know them and have good times together, not only in science, but having a good drink and dinner afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely.
Become really good friends.
And during this period of time, did you start to think about where you wanted to do the science that you were doing? Were you starting to... Because you mentioned you went to Pittsburgh for a specific reason, right? It wasn't a top-tier school, but there was a group of people there that was doing stuff that you were interested in. As you're pursuing this area of science, were you thinking about, you know, like you got a grant, so you're at Pittsburgh, and you had this opportunity to go to the Institut Pasteur. Were there other places that you were considering going to?
Not really. I was asked to go to other couple of other places and go on their staff, but I wanted to stay exactly where I was and do the research I was doing, which was, after a year or so, was unique in the laboratory. I was doing things that nobody else did. So I got the grants that I was doing that nobody else was. And that made me a separate individual. Hmm. And this, when we then moved and came west, we can get into that, that became very important. Hmm.
When you applied to the Institut Pasteur, is that the right terminology? Did you apply to be hosted there? Did you have a job lined up? Like, how did you... I'm guessing you were writing letters back and forth to parents.
Yes, I wrote to Pierre Grobar, who was the head of it, and told him that I'd like to come over and spend a year doing science with his people. And... I was accepted by him. There were others I could go to who were probably more in the area that I was, but to go to Paris.
Sure.
And something completely different was something I chose to do.
Did it come with a financial package?
No,
you?
I brought you, all...
Yeah, okay. Lab access.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it was 1 year.
Yes.
1959, when you decided to move out there and spend the year with them. Was it, I have the Department of Microbiological Chemistry. Is that where you started it in Paris?
In Paris, yes.
Yes, okay. And who did you work with there? Was there any...
Pretty much by myself. I worked in a laboratory with another very nice guy, but whose name is, I just can't pull up.
But he did his, he shared a laboratory, but not necessarily doing research with you. Is
right.
Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But what I tried to do was do the work that they're doing. And, which was okay, I could do that. It wasn't terribly serious and that kind of work. And it wasn't immunology.
What was it?
Have to go back.
Okay. Did you get to do some of your immunology work while you were out there?
No, not really. I gave my talks in immunology, which they all liked to hear something completely different. But I must say, getting to know the people there in Grobar's organization was a delight.
Good.
Such neat people.
So when you were, based on that experience and you're wrapping up 1960s, what are you starting to think about your career paths, or how do you want to grow from this experience that you had in Paris? What's going through your brain at this time?
Oh, well, I was doing my immunology and the kinds of studies that I was interested in doing. And did do, each one which was novel, and each one produced more novel things, so that's what was governing me. And it was starting with the antigen and antigen-antibody complexes and the inflammation they produced, and then that got me into studies of inflammation. What was there in inflammation that was causing the damage? And I started that in Pittsburgh, and then, you know, I told you that we at the University of Pittsburgh, we all had grants, but the head of the president of the university wanted to take all of our grants through his office and be reviewed to decide whether we should get them or not. But we all gave him the middle finger. and left the University of Pittsburgh.
Okay.
I wonder if he realized the mistakes he made in losing this group. Because our group of five was producing so much science and in journals and so forth that we became very popular. And that's what also, when we decided to leave the University of Pittsburgh, we had a number of different places that wanted to pick us up. But one of them that we did do was out here with Edmund Keeney at the Scripps Clinic.
That was, Dave, I don't know if you want to get into a Scripps Clinic or talk about the 1960s, or is there anything else we should cover?
That was 1961.
Yeah, anything else to cover in the late 50s?
Nothing that was that came to my mind specifically. I mean, you did mention that there are places interested in these people from Pittsburgh, and I was curious to know, like, how did places reach out to you all to say, hey, look, we know you're at Pittsburgh, but, you know, why don't you come here? How are you being contacted? How are people finding you?
Well, we would, I especially, would be giving talks at these meetings. And so people would listen to the talk and they'd think, well, that's something that we'd like to have in our organization. So they would ask me to come to their organization. And, you know, there are all kinds of really good universities that I could have gone to, but I wanted to stay right where I was and finish there.
That's all I wanted to ask, Michelle.
Okay. You mentioned working with having your own postdocs. Did that happen for the first time in Paris, or was that when you came back?
When I came back and we moved.
Okay.
We moved out here to California.
Okay, so let's turn to that time then. This is 1961, is it, when you decide to move back here? Tell us a little bit about what's happening.
That was the big year. Well, Ed Keeney, that's got a thing on the...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't worry, when that comes up, it's still recording us.
Ed Keeney wanted us to, wanted to have some science along with the physicians in the Scripps Clinic. So we asked us to come out, and he built a new building for us with one extra floor. So we took floors 1 through 4, and then the 5th floor was on top, which I'll get to in a minute. And we each got labs there, and...
Who's we? You've been saying we.
Weigel, Feldman, Dixon, myself. And we went to work in our labs, and the idea was that... And he gave us a lunch to have with the clinicians, a free lunch. And we'd all come together, and he thought the clinicians who would have unsolved problems with their patients could then talk with the scientists and tell the scientists about the problems, and then the scientists could even do some studies to find out what the problems were with these patients. The difficulty that he faced was that when we scientists got together, we were talking our science with the others, and we couldn't stop talking. So yes, we met the clinicians and enjoyed being with them, but we didn't do much of what Ed Keeney wanted us to do. But Ed was a marvelous human being, and he really liked then having all the work we were doing, and publishing papers, which was adding a lot of knowledge, a lot of it. The pleasure of people have in knowing about the Scripps Clinic and Research Foundation, which was what it was called. The other thing is that we were back in Pittsburgh. Jonah Salk was there, and he had his rhesus monkeys, and he vaccinated the rhesus monkeys with poliovirus, killed poliovirus, and found that when he would challenge them with active polio, that they were resistant and not get the disease. And I got to know him there in Pittsburgh, which was a real pleasure. And then he moved out to the West Coast and had the 5th floor in our department. So he was there. He didn't do much work in that because they were building the Salk Institute up here, which is huge.
Did you first find out about the Scripps opportunity while you were in Paris? Or did you move back to Pittsburgh after Paris, or did you go directly
from... I went back to Pittsburgh.
Okay.
For the final year.
Okay.
And that's when we were making the decision.
And that's when you made the decision. Okay, yeah. And what was the reputation of Scripps like at this time? 1960, 61.
Zero. There was nothing there.
Right. So tell us more. Did that feel like it must have been exciting to be the start of something new? maybe scary?
Getting our new labs and that were, because up in Pittsburgh we were sort of working in a mixture, but there we, each one of us had a lab, and we had, so this is the beginning of the growth of the Research Institute. We could grow because each of us had research grants, and we would continue to do our study in that area, and new areas kept bouncing, kept coming up, that we would discover that, gosh, these three things are saying that there's one more thing that's needed, and that's the fourth, but we need to learn about it. So then we would start doing studies in that fourth area, and we'd get a new grant to do that.
Is this NIH funding?
NIH funding, which we would apply to, and it would, our, it's peer reviewed. So, and then I actually ended up being on one of the peer reviewers, which is a scientist going over other grant applications. But we then kept building that, and the other thing we put into our grant was that there were young people who wanted to come and work in our lab and find out what we were doing and learn what we were doing because they were interested in that. And these would be postdoctoral fellows. So they all had degrees. And so they would then learn, work in our lab and learn what all the science was and build up that way. And so I would, in my grant applications, I would put more into it to bring in more postdoctoral fellows. There was one particularly good one. He was in England and he wanted to come over. His name was Roger Allen. And I didn't have a grant for him at the time. And I said, Roger, I'm sorry, I can't take you right now, but give me some time. And about 6 months later, I got a new grant that would funded another postdoctoral fellow. So I wrote him a letter and said, I've now got a grant, you can come. And he said, I can't believe it. He'd taken a different job, but he left that other job anyway and came out. And he was, I think, about 22 years old. And he came to the lab. I'd always, when they'd come to the lab as a postdoctoral fellow, I would tell them the various areas that were being done in the lab that they might be interested in, and they would select the area they'd like to be in. So Roger came, and I said, he's very tall and one of the best-looking guys I'd ever seen in my life. And I said, Roger, here are the various things that you could be interested in, and he made a selection. And then I noticed in the next 3 or 4 days, there were young women who kept coming to the lab that I'd never seen. They wanted to eyeball Roger Allen and maybe try to get to know him.
Right.
I tell you, he was just a fabulous guy. And we had, I had such great interest in the postdocs, and they would get them, make sure they had their names on papers that were published, so that after 3 or 4 years they could get jobs on the staff of other universities, and that they did. They spread out all over the world, and then I had postdoctoral fellows coming from not only England but from Poland and Germany and France and England. And it was just,
well, let's talk a bit about that. You are running the Division of Experimental Pathology at this time at the Scripps Institute, is that correct?
The
Division of Experimental Pathology, is that what you are?
Okay,
that's
right.
Where you're based right now?
Yeah.
And are people finding you and writing to you? Are they including a sample of their writing or research and saying, would you consider me? Or do you have people in mind that you said, oh,
no,
I
they
know.
Would write
They're
to
writing
me.
To you.
I didn't
yeah.
know any of them.
Got it.
But they'd hear me give a talk or they'd uh-huh. read the articles I'd written. And so they wanted to come and learn about that.
That's so as far as Poland, people are hearing about your work and writing to you saying they want to come?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
And I was asked to give talks in Poland.
What other places? So England, Poland, where else is your work being respected and heard?
All over this country.
Okay.
But also Italy.
Yep.
So it was, became a worldwide, oh, and Japan. I had postdoctoral fellows there coming from Japan.
What piece of your work seems to be resonating with these international audiences? What's starting to really build your reputation?
Oh, just the studies we were, variety of studies we were doing in vitro in the lab, but also in experimental animals.
Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like? So you get to Scripps. Prior to being there, it sounded like you were an independent researcher, right? You had your money, you did your work, you published your results. You might have spoken with other people in the lab. You had learned some stuff from them in the early years. But you were the researcher doing your research. As you start to take on postdocs, as you're bringing people into your lab, does your role change with respect to the science that you are doing yourself, but also with regard to the people in your lab? Did you have to take on like management responsibilities to ensure that these postdocs were getting their work done? Were you overseeing their work, writing articles with them? How did the nature of the time that you committed to your own work change, if at all, with regard to having responsibilities for other people?
Well, you got to realize that the postdocs who were there were doing my research. So we did it together. And we were talking all the time. We had, on Mondays, there would be two or three who would give a talk about what they'd been doing. And I would also be giving talks like that on Monday mornings. So it was really sort of a combination, but each one was unique in what he or she were up to, and I was the same. So it was, a real pleasure to have this big group together, all doing similar work, and that they would keep telling the other their associates what was happening. And they would learn. Somebody would say, well, you know, if you did this, it would solve that problem. So it was a good unity that we had. But we didn't have anybody on the outside telling us what to do. Or I would get to that. Of course, I knew what all the others were doing. So if there was something I could add that would help them, I would tell them about it. But it was their science and their research grant. The other important thing was that the chairman of our department, Frank Dixon, could not tell us one thing that we had to do. And we did much more science than he did. In fact, it's interesting that I never saw him do any science. I never saw him with a pipette in his hand or tubes with fluids in them, and he was adding things. He would sit back and watch everybody else.
Was he more of the manager, would you say? Is he in a managerial role?
Well, no, because he couldn't tell us what to do.
That's true.
He just had to keep the place alive. And he was not the most popular person in the building.
It sounds like you took your mentorship role quite seriously with your postdocs.
Oh, well, so that they would feel independent and they could learn things and be on so many research articles and publications that they would be offered positions as assistant professors when they went somewhere else.
And did that happen? Were they successful?
Oh, yes. Oh, they did. It was really, really good.
How many postdocs passed through your lab over the years, do you know, roughly?
Over 100.
Wow, okay.
In fact, I forgot the exact date, but they all decided to come back and be with me and thank me for the time. And I had this, I have a picture of them. About 80 of them all came back to thank me for what they learned and did in the lab.
Do you remember when that was?
I think it was about 1999, right towards the end.
That's lovely.
And, you know, to see your postdoc, most of them didn't know each other, but they all got up in an auditorium and each would present the work that he was now doing to the others, and it made them all feel good. But they didn't know each other. I remember one time at a lunch, somebody did this with the food, and then he got the food back. These are postdocs.
Right. Do some of them stand out in your minds that maybe they went on to something that you felt like you influenced them, or just someone you had a strong relationship with?
Oh, they all took the work they did in the lab and the knowledge they had in the lab and put that, they either kept that going or they would expand it into different areas. So that's what they did.
Yeah.
And they became professors and full professors, and all came, when they left the lab, they were all at least assistant professors. Mm. So they had a new, good life, just like I had had.
And did you keep in touch with some of them? I know all came back, but you continued to keep in touch. Yeah, that's lovely.
Yeah, we were all not only scientific colleagues, we were friends. Mm-hmm. And families. The families all knew each other.
Yeah.
Many of them were not married when they arrived, but they were married after they left.
Well, I was going to ask, like, what was it like? Because Scripps is just getting started. It's pretty small. What is this area like? Is it built up? Does everyone know each other? Or you all live and work in the same... Does it feel like a very small, intimate community at this time?
We all knew each other, and we kind of kept an eye on what the others were doing because we were good friends. Mm-hmm. And the postdocs that they would bring in, we got to know them too. And the work they were doing. So that was a real pleasure.
Did people live in San Diego and commute, or are you living right around the Scripps campus?
Some would live up in Del Mar area.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And then would come down. But in general, they lived in the area here.
Around La Jolla,
mm-hmm.
Somewhere, yeah.
And, you know, it was a pleasure having them come from different countries, or down from Seattle. I had several from Seattle, and work in the lab. And I'd given talks up in Seattle, so they'd heard me, and that's one of the things that got them started.
And are they mostly men?
No, there are quite a few, well, mostly men, but there were quite a few women who came into this too. And they're in that picture.
When did you start to get more female postdocs coming in?
Immediately.
Okay, yeah.
Because they weren't necessarily through medical school, they'd gotten PhDs. But in medical school, it took some time before more women were admitted, and they realized that women could make as good doctors as males, if not better.
And is it mostly white students that came through your lab? Or
I had a mixture.
That started to get more diverse too, yeah.
But, yeah. As in college, when I wanted to bring a new member of the fraternity, a black kid I'd gotten to know well on the campus, and they wouldn't accept it, which made me mad. Why not have a black guy, a member of the same fraternity? What's different about him? besides skin. So I always really appreciated black students who did well.
Did you have any black students, postdocs that worked for you?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Along with women.
Mm-hmm. Good. Dave, do you want to ask anything else about the postdocs or take a break before anything? How are you feeling?
I might say a couple of things about the growth of the Research Institute.
That's what I'm wondering. Do we want to do that now, or how's it going, Dave?
Well, so it depends on how much longer you want to go today, but there is something I realized before we started, we mentioned we were going to ask about, and then we forgot to ask about it. So I would want to return to that, just a brief thing.
I thought of that as well. When I arrived here, I saw on your table this photograph that I believe Ansel Adams took of you at Rochester Medicine. Could you tell me a little bit more about why there's a photo of you from Ansel Adams?
Well, I was having a quick bite to eat in the cafe at the medical school because I was going to go to a 1 o'clock lecture that I wanted to hear, and while I was gobbling as fast as I could, this man who didn't have hair on top of his head came in and said, I'd like to take a picture of you. And I said, I'm sorry, but I've got a lecture I really want to go to. He said, well, it's for the university. I said, really? Well, if it's for the university, it's done a lot of good for me, so you can take that picture. So we went up to the surgical suites, and I had to strip down and put on surgical gowns, which is the first time I'd seen those things or wore them. And he took the pictures over an hour period of time. And then I said to him, listen, could I get a negative? Because then I can take a copy of the picture. And he laughed as hard as I've ever seen somebody laugh. Because all of his, I didn't know who he was, of course, but all of his negatives are held in vaults because they're so expensive.
Right.
And so he sent me a positive about a month. I said, well, could you, I said, for my family that, who put me through school and paid for everything. And so he then sent me a positive, and that's where this made copies of that.
So they're gorgeous black and white photographs that he took of you and some of your colleagues in the lab.
Just me.
Oh, okay. I thought these might have been.
Yeah, that's Whipple.
Okay.
One of the reasons I went to medical school there.
But they chose you on the cover of the Rochester Medicine. This is the fall-winter 2002 University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry publication, and we have Charlie on the cover from Ansel Adams. So it's a beautiful photograph. I'm going to pause it, Dave.
Start the recording again and just say that this is the second session. Also joining us is so.
Okay, this is our, we're recording now. This is Michelle DeMeo. I'm here with David Caruso, and I'm being joined by Charles Cochran and his wife, Monica Cochran. It is still June 3rd. This is our second session after a short break. So Dave, do you want to kick us off on where we'll pick up now?
Well, I think Charlie mentioned that he had some more stuff to say about those early years at Scripps, because we do also want to understand how the institution developed over time. I think you mentioned that you were on one floor, your colleagues were on different floors, Salk was on the fifth floor. But we do want to know, since Scripps was in its foundation, how did it grow? How did it change over time? So, whatever you think we need to know to sort of also hear that story?
Well, there were the five of us who were there to get it started. each of us had grants that we had applied for and gotten for the work we were doing. And since they were different, all the grants were different as well. And the important thing about the grants was that it meant that we would do that research and nobody could tell us what to do. And if we didn't do very good research, we wouldn't get the grants reapplied, we would lose our salaries, and we'd be out of the building. On the other hand, if our research was going well, and we were getting into new areas, and we were getting more grants, our lab would grow bigger, and we would grow bigger, and therefore the whole institution grew bigger. And that happened. Also, we got brought in postdoctoral fellows who did very well, and I'm one of them, and several others who would get them then put on our staff as assistant professors at Scripps, and then they would become unique and do their work, and that's the whole place started expanding like that. Over the years, and you got to realize we were those that we would bring in as postdoctoral fellows. We looked at very carefully, and then over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, we could see that they were really good at their ability to do research projects and think of new things to do. So then they would become independent and would get a lab of their own. Of course, we were also bringing in people from other universities who were doing work that was unique and that we would like to include in the work we were doing. And there were several people like this who were just really superb, like Hans Müller-Eberhard, who we brought in from the East Coast, from Philadelphia, from New York. And several others that did unique work that would benefit us all.
Could you talk a little bit about that? What were some of the strengths of the research taking place at the Scripps Institute at this time? Is this work focusing on oxidant injury of cells? What other materials were you working on?
Well, I can tell you some about what we were working on in my lab, but not what the others were doing. They were doing unique work, and I'd have to scramble my brain to remember some of them.
Okay, yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about your research then.
We were working on immunology and also the inflammation that goes with immunology, and what there was that was causing the inflammation, and then what was being done to repair our cells from getting inflammatory injury going even farther.
And what did you learn about that? What are some of the mechanisms that are taking place to repair?
Okay, well now this is getting into a whole bunch of stuff. All right.
Yeah.
I made some notes. I also sent you details on this. But in terms of inflammation and inflammatory injury, we started out using antigens and producing antibodies to those antigens and then testing out how they would work to produce the inflammatory damage in the skin, or glomerulonephritis in the kidneys, and arteritis. And the first thing found that with the antigen antibody complex, it would bind complement components. And this is where we had the I got the help from one of the people who came in named Hans Müller Eberhard, because his sole area was studying complement, the various components of complement.
Where was he before he joined you?
He joined the our group.
But did you say he was already working on this before he came to Scripps?
Oh, yes. He was in New York.
In New York.
And he was very good at studying complement and determining the, what the complement components were. So we realized how this could we could use his information.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the work we were doing in my lab needed it more than anybody else. So when the antigen and the antibody would come together, they would bind the complement components. And the important one that, that at least one of the important ones that we looked at was the third component, or C3, and leukocyte, the polymorphonuclear leukocytes, or neutrophils, would bind to that complement component in the vessels and in the glomeruli. And they would then they would remove the complement components because they would break it down. And then one of the components, the fifth component, would be broken down by what our proteases were doing and produce C5A. And C5A is a fragment of the fifth component, and that would attract leukocytes. And we could determine that by having a chamber with an upper and a lower level and separated by a membrane that had tiny holes that leukocytes could go through. And we'd put leukocytes in the upper chamber, and then we'd put various things to stimulate them in the lower chamber, and that's where we found that C5A really stimulated the movement of the neutrophils from the upper to the lower chamber, and therefore in the body, they would C5A would be something that would be attracting the PMNs. And with C5 there, and with the complement components there, first of all, the neutrophils would bind to the C3, but then C5A would stimulate them to release the enzymes. The enzymes that were really important were elastase, because the elastase would break down the membranes that the complement, that the leukocytes were sticking to, like the basement membranes in the kidney or in the arteries. And in the kidney, when they would break down the basement membranes, it would allow the protein, plasma proteins, to go right into the urine.
Mm.
And that's what causes the problems with people with nephritis. And then we found that if we used inhibitors for the elastase, we could prevent damage to the basement membranes and stop the plasma from flowing into the urine. So this is the kind of research you do as you mm-hmm. go on, and you find out the first thing, and then you say, wow, let's try to find an inhibitor. And we did. We had got good inhibitors to elastase, and that prevented the damage to the glomeruli. And this is all stuff that could be picked up and used for human disease.
Mm-hmm. What were you? Did you have animal studies at
all
this time?
All done in animals,
yeah.
And rabbits and mm-hmm. guinea pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we studied the mechanism of the deposition of the antigen antibody complexes in the glomeruli and in the arteries. And we found that the important thing to be involved were platelets, and that they would be stimulated to release a particular drugs that would then get the leukocytes to stick. And the way that happened was that the immune complexes would stimulate basophils, which are circulating leukocytes, and they would release what's called a platelet-stimulating factor, and then that would react with the platelets to release vasoactive amines, would cause the sticking of the leukocyte. I'm sorry, I'm probably getting into this.
Well, I have a question, because just to back up a little bit, you mentioned how important it was for the plasma proteins to stop them from going into the urine, and that there was an immediate benefit to nephrology that you noticed. Could you talk a little bit about, as you were doing this, when did you start to realize, oh my gosh, this is really significant for these different fields or these different types of diseases? Could you talk a little bit about the where you noticed the impact of your work?
Well,
or the potential for it, maybe.
I must say, I spent very little time thinking about what it could do for the human disease.
Okay.
But I did realize that if we're dealing with glomeruli in a rabbit, yeah, they're probably the same for glomeruli in the human being. And that's why we kept working with the animals in vivo and doing in vitro work. So while I realized it could be very beneficial to the humans and to human medicine, we didn't go into that.
When did human trials start? Much later? Or it was never done for this kind of research?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
I don't know. It was some of the others coming up, I'll be
okay.
able to answer
yeah.
that question.
I was also, before you begin again, I was curious to know what sort of technologies you were using in the lab at this period of time. You know, I'm familiar with more modern science and some of the laboratory equipment that people are using today, the expensive laboratory equipment. What were you using in your labs to, perform the experiments to analyze what you were gathering from your animal models? Were you using separation columns? Were you using mass spec devices? Like, what was the technology that you were using to do this analysis?
Well, a lot of it was separating proteins and other things on the columns. And we had many different kinds of columns that could be used for specific reasons. And we used ultracentrifuges also to get, like, if there were complexes of things, they would ultracentrifuge down. And then a lot of just straight chemistry. Finding out what what kind of a molecule that it was that we were dealing with.
And what about the data analysis? Were you doing those calculations by hand, or did you have access to mainframe computer systems at that point to run programs to help you sort the data?
Well, we didn't have early types of computers, but most of it was just finding out. We could detect changes by the chemicals that would interact with the split products of the original thing. So we could tell whether that original thing was being broken up or not. If it's being broken up and creating things that were important, we could then detect them chemically. And when we get these chemical works working and knowledgeable, we would be able to use them for new systems coming along. So we really had a background of a number of chemical ways of detecting changes that then we would use on all the new things that came along.
So I assume that these were, you're publishing your findings as you're going in major journals. The NIH is continuing to fund this research as
yeah.
well, and you're, okay.
Oh, it was, NIH was certainly funding it all. Mm-hmm. And each new area would give us a new thing for the next application. Because Well, the applications would go for, I think, 4 years, and then we'd have to renew them. And we'd, so we'd, with the second series of 4 years, we'd have a whole bunch of new science that we had developed. And of course, each year we would be submitting that to the NIH as evidence of the science done during that year. So the next thing was the molecular structure of a different area of the leukocytes, and this is the kinin forming system, bradykinin and the kinins. And we found that the reason we got into this was that in the absence of the polymorphonuclear leukocytes or neutrophils, we were still getting a small leakage of protein in the glomeruli when the antigen and antibody complexes stuck there. And so we wanted to find out what was causing that continued, albeit minor, leakage. And then we found that there was a group of 5 proteins that would come together and stimulate each other. One was clotting factor 12, or Hageman factor. Another was prekallikrein, then clotting factor 11, and then high molecular weight kininogen, and they would react with each other. And and would then release something that came from the prekallikrein, which is called bradykinin. And bradykinin is something that causes leakage of proteins from blood vessels. And that's what caused the increase in vascular permeability that we were seeing in the kidney, even though we had taken the leukocytes out. And then one thing about the business of the kallikrein and bradykinin and the development, the release of bradykinin, that it causes inflammation and leakage of protein, is that this has been found in various types of human pulmonary diseases. Mm. And they found that because of the work that we had done in the animals. That's where animal studies help human beings. Mm-hmm. Then the fourth area that we worked in is the oxidative injury of tissues. And when the leukocytes are interacted with antigen and antibody complexes, they release oxidants. And the oxidants are inflammatory. And the oxidants then affect the proteins around, and then the changed proteins can affect the functions of cells. So this is another area that leukocytes do that's very important, is releasing oxidants. And then to study what the oxidants did, we developed specific inhibitors of the oxidants. And when we inhibited the oxidants that were released by the leukocytes, we found that decreased the injury of tissues. And this has continued into human beings. In human studies, such as respiratory distress syndrome, where oxidants do damage the tissues, and these are oxidants that come from the leukocytes.
So what were the inhibitors that you created?
I wish I could tell you. I'd have to go back through the literature to find out.
Okay.
And number 5, which is the final one, We began some studies with the surfactants in the lung, and surfactants form a monolayer in the alveoli and keep them from closing down from the elastic tissue around. So we got some surfactants, we got some surfactant material from infants who had died, and we get lavages from their alveoli. And I took that to analyze the protein that was present, and put it over a column, and which was an aqueous column, and found there's a precipitate of proteins at the top of the column, which I couldn't believe, because otherwise they should go down. And I did that several times. The thing has come back up. And this would... I did it several times, and then I took that precipitate at the top and put it into organic solvents like alcoholic solvents, and it dissolved. So here it was, a hydrophobic protein that dissolved in non-aqueous substances, and I found the protein involved in that and called it surfactant protein B. And then the thing was that since that came from the lung, maybe it played a role in the problems that premature kids have when they haven't made surfactant. So I took the surfactant protein B, and which I can mix with the phospholipids, because the surfactant protein and phospholipids bond to each other. And this is the dipalmitoyl phosphatidylcholine, or DPPC, and the two together would then form a unit that would be the full-term surfactant. And so I analyzed the surfactant protein B and got an analysis of the entire amino acid sequence. And then I made peptides that contained portions of that sequence, and so I could analyze what there was in the total protein that was important in binding to the phospholipids and causing and forming calico, forming the bradic, the too many words, the surfactant. And so I got the peptides and found out that the ones that were active had positively charged amino acid and then some non-charged and then another positively charged in this combination. So then I made a simplified version of it, which was potassium and four leucines and potassium, 21 residues like that, which I call KL4 surfactant. And that would mix then with the phospholipid. And the phospholipid has these rigid side chains that go out, and then it has the that are hydrophobic, and it has the hydrophilic parts at the bottom, and they would interact with the lysines of the KL4, and the leucines would go up with the side chains of the dipalmitoyl phosphatidylcholine and hold it in place. So that's how that would hold the surfactant. That's what made surfactant is what it is in terms of holding the alveoli open, mm-hmm. with a single monolayer around the inside of the alveolus.
Sorry, do you have a copy of the Science cover? Because that has exactly what
I do have a copy of it.
Do you know where it is?
Not here. They science liked the article that we submitted to it so much they put it on the cover.
That's great.
It's a really cool drawing.
Do you know what year that was?
91.
I have one of the covers.
Yeah, where would that be?
I have it. It's in the books. My book.
Is like it in this. The book?
It's on the left side.
Let's
of
see
that
if I can find bookcase. It. By your desk.
Yeah.
Okay. Dave, did you want to jump in?
Nothing specific at the moment. I know that you're kind of summarizing the work over the 25 years, right? So starting in the early 60s to the late 80s. So it's good to know that. I'm sure we'll have questions, though, about what was happening on a more regular basis in the labs as this research is going on and who's involved and who's talking about it and stuff like that. But yeah, I'd like to hear what it is that you were progressing towards.
Well, we did that and finding out how for the first time in the world what keeps an alveolus open and how it does it. And that's these side chains of the phospholipid, and they're being held together by a protein, surfactant protein B, or my KL4, and that holds it like that, so it can't.
So this is I'm holding an illustration on the cover of Science from the 25th of October, 1991. This is illustrating what you're talking about right now. Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
And that's the article. Too.
Okay. So this is the SPB protein. This is an article from you and SD Revic. Is that how you pronounce it? Revic? Okay.
She's the technician.
She's your technician, okay. Who came up with this illustration? Is this your illustration?
You did.
I did, yeah.
And this was accepted as an illustration, as a model for what you were working on?
Yeah.
Yes.
They asked for this to put on the cover.
It's great.
And this is the KL4. These are the leucine, lysine, and this is the K, the potassium.
So sorry, for the audio listeners, yeah, the orange part is the
hydrophobic.
Okay.
And this is hydrophilic.
The yellow part's hydrophilic.
And these are hydrophilic head groups of the phospholipid.
You're pointing to the circles below.
Yeah, circles below. And then they have the side chains that go up, rigid side chains. And they're held together by the KL4 or by surfactant protein B.
Got it. Yeah, that's fascinating.
And so you can't squish that thing down because of those rigid side chains. Mm-hmm. So
why was this immediately picked up as being significant? This is the first time we've ever seen this.
It was ever known that it mm-hmm. keeps the alveoli open mm-hmm. and preterm infants. And they started putting the KL4 surfactant into a human being. First, we did it in rabbits mm-hmm. and preterm rhesus monkeys, preterm rabbits, mm-hmm. and it worked in them very well. And then we put it into some human beings.
Were they children? There's babies? Did they allow that for the trials? Okay.
Yeah. That had not made it, mm-hmm. so they were, when they're born, they turn blue and mm-hmm. and they have very, very little oxygen in their arteries. Mm-hmm. So it was learning how the monolayer of surfactant works and how it keeps these rigid side chains and how the surfactant protein B does that. And it became so important that they heard about it back east in Sweden. And they went and gave a Nobel lecture, Monica with me and I, and we gave a Nobel lecture to a whole bunch of those people, including Nobel laureates. And we had a dinner afterwards.
When this was in the 90s?
Yeah.
94
maybe?
Somewhere between 93 and 95.
So we got a free trip to Europe for that.
Who were some of the Nobel laureates that you spoke to while you were out there?
Because the story he's about to tell is that I called myself a Nobel sandwich. At dinner.
Yeah, at dinner, she was sitting between two Nobel laureates.
John Vane and Bengt Samuelson.
Bengt Samuelson.
You don't forget that.
No.
And I'd known Bengt Samuelson for quite a while, a delightful guy. Yeah. And then he was put the head of the Nobel Committee.
Right.
But to be there.
That shows the significance of this work.
Of the work, yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, as I mentioned, it started going into human infants. And we, instead of using it as a whole bunch of them, about 1,200, it went into around the world, and they were doing very well.
So these are, this is some of your first human trials?
Yeah, I didn't do them. They were done by other people.
And, got it.
But they would get the surfactant had to be made by a company that could make it to be absolutely clean and so forth. We didn't do any of that sort of thing. So we got a company going near Philadelphia.
What company was that?
The first name of it was called the Science.
Well, very first name. This was the one in Doylestown.
Okay.
Acute Therapeutics was the very first name.
Yeah.
And then it went to Discovery Laboratories. And it's now yet something else.
Windtree.
Okay, so they're the ones, they're making the product and they're administering the trials?
And then they would send it out to the,
send it out
the various
to,
trials.
Yeah. And how involved are you in this process? You're just waiting for results to come back to you at this point?
Oh, yeah.
It was approved. It's FDA approved.
It's FDA approved at this point.
Years ago.
Okay. Were you involved in the FDA approval process?
No. But it was done by the company. And I remember one day I was standing right there and the phone rang. Monica handed it to me. And it was one of the guys at the company, a good, really guy, nice guy. And he said, "Charles, in 2 seconds you're going to be a very happy man. The FDA approved."
I can only imagine how exciting that must have felt.
You did, Charlie. You did go in the early years when it was J&J, because they had it first. You did go to the FDA meetings with them, and you also went to the EMEA in London with Discovery Labs, the English version of...
She knows me better than I do.
This is helpful, yeah.
Helps to be the admin.
What did you have to do? So what was your role in that? You went and spoke about the...
Ask my admin.
I didn't get to go. I went on the trip, but I couldn't go to the FDA or the EMEA.
Okay.
They went off to the meeting, and then I heard about it afterwards.
Okay.
But there were regulations that the EMEA wanted the company, as I remember it, wanted the company to work on before they would have given
approval. Yeah.
And then it came first from the FDA, from our FDA.
Okay.
And that EMEA meeting was in 2006.
I think we were already in
Europe.
It was either
5 or 6.
Hmm? We were in Europe already.
We were.
Yeah. So those were good times and very enjoyable. I think especially that felt good about it being recognized in Sweden.
Absolutely.
About how the monolayer of surfactant works to keep an alveolus open.
Right.
It's a big deal. Mm-hmm. So many babies are dying.
Yeah. Did you want to jump in, Dave? I'm not sure.
Well, it depends on where we want to go at this point in time. I also do want to hear, so you told us about the progression of your science. I'm also interested in knowing how your lab changed over the years in terms of its size, in terms of its productivity. I'm also curious to know about Scripps itself and how it changed over time. I think when you first started there, it was the Scripps Clinic and Research Foundation, then it becomes the Scripps Research Institute. So I'm also interested in knowing a bit more about those institutional changes and how that impacted, or if it impacted, the work that you were doing or the work that others were doing. And I'm also curious to know, I think you became an adjunct professor of pathology at the University of California, San Diego, starting in 68. So I'm wondering how that connection came into existence and what your responsibilities were. So, you know, I'd like to hear more about those years in addition to what you already mentioned about the science specifically. But again, I know now we're getting close to another hour passing, so that might be stuff to cover in the next session. It's kind of up to you.
We can do it right now. The expansion of the Research Institute and the separation from the clinic occurred after we had moved up away from the coast area of La Jolla up to the Torrey Pines area, and the expansion of the buildings occurred up there. We got new directors that replaced Frank Dixon, a guy named Richard Lerner, and he was very good at bringing companies in and people in to put money into it, and therefore we built new buildings and we could expand into a whole bunch of new areas that the Research Institute wanted to. And then it separated from the Scripps Clinic up there, and the boards of directors then became two instead of one. And as I said, we had a new Richard Lerner replacing Frank Dixon, and Richard was particularly good at building and new buildings and bringing in new people. So that's the administrative side of it. In the labs, we would and each lab could keep expanding that lab as we did more and more research and getting more and more grants and more and more people. So that expanded that way. And I think that was the major way in which the Institute really expanded, besides bringing new people in. Then Richard Lerner finally stepped down, and we got a new director, Pete Schultz, who's there now, who you met, I think. Were you there at the meeting?
Yeah. No. I didn't. I know Grace met him, yeah, and he was, yes.
He's the guy who tucks you with a dog in his lap?
Yes, I heard. Yes.
That's how you know it's Pete Schultz.
So when did he take over then? That was...
around 10 years ago.
10 years. More than that, right?
Maybe more.
We retired 19 years ago, and he was already there. So it's probably 25.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you remember him coming in and how that changed the work you were doing?
No, it didn't change our work. Okay. Came in after we left.
No, he came in way before, because he was already there, but he wasn't... I'm not positive whether... Yeah, he... I cannot... It's funny what you forget. He was there before we left, but...
She's the one who knows all this stuff.
But I do not remember.
You were exactly. Working at Scripps as well?
Yeah.
So can you tell?
He was my boss in the lab.
Yeah, when did you join, Monica?
I was there 27 years, so I joined in 78, January of 78.
And what was your job?
The administrative side of the lab, running Charlie's lab. The lab comprised at that point of about 50 people, but that was not only his big lab, it was several others as well. So I He was my primary boss, but there were others whose work I then did. This was before the days. In fact, a lovely thing, ours was the lab with the very first word processors. It's Scripps Research.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit? So your...
We had a Wang. And there was nobody to ask because there weren't any other labs that had word processors. So I did everything on a typewriter.
Right.
No matter how many carbon copies, you know, that's what CC stands for, yep. Carbon copies we actually needed. I always had carbon copies there. It was wild when you look back on it, on something like that. It was fun, though. So we had a Wang word processor, and then we grew up and went to other ones.
Right, right. Turns you around, Dave, so you can see Monica as well.
Hi.
Ask questions.
Sure. So, I do want, as the lab grew, how did it change, right? Did your responsibilities change? What were the interactions like? Because, I can imagine when you're a small group, people that you knew quite well for a number of years, there's a lot of interaction that's going to happen. As institutions grow, those interactions might be more difficult to have, right? Within labs, among labs. So I'm also curious to know how the nature of, not the research itself, but maybe the research environment changed at Scripps over the years with its expansion, with its growth, if that makes sense.
Well, of course, the more labs there were and the more people brought in from the outside made it a added differences along the line. And it was hard to then keep track of what the various new scientists were doing, or even knowing them, because they'd be brought in without your knowledge. And Pete Schultz did a major difference, and that is from the science going on would be built therapeutics for human beings, because he came in from an organization called CALIBER, the California...
Something for research.
The biology. But in CALIBER, which was just in an institution right near ours, they made therapeutics and developed therapeutics for human beings, and it made the company very well to do. So they brought him in as Richard Lerner's replacement as the director of Scripps Research Institute. And he has built many, added a lot of people. They're doing now a lot of work in clinical areas. And so it's a much different organization now than what it was when we were there. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. I objected to it originally, but as long as they kept the basic science going, then I would approve it. Okay. The other thing about it is that the organization now has so many publications that come out that they were reviewed by the British journal Nature, and they brought in a series of, made a group that was judging various scientific institutions around the world, and you know the story. They found, based upon the number of publications that coming from the organizations, and then the number of quotes of the science from other scientists, they judged Scripps to be number one in this country, mm-hmm. which made us all feel pretty good.
Sure.
Especially us, the kids, the five that, of course, they aren't alive now, but made me feel really proud to
Absolutely.
Have gotten this all going. And now doing so much good with the therapies that are coming from the scientific work.
You'd also mentioned that in those early years, under the change in leadership, there was a move to bring in not just additional grants, but I think you mentioned the word investors, companies, to provide funds to the research institute itself. Did I hear that correctly?
Richard Lerner, yeah, brought in, yes. And so did, I'm sure, did Peter Schultz. Companies that would, I can't be sure of this, and you probably shouldn't quote me on this, but the I think companies would be interested in helping develop therapeutics and therefore would put money into the science that goes into building them.
Well, that's how J&J became involved with your research.
With Richard Lerner.
No, yeah. It was Frank Dixon. I think there was a $20 million J&J agreement with Scripps Research that they had
right... I think that was Richard.
I think it was Frank. Right of first refusal.
Mm.
Okay, yeah, see they overlap. I'm not sure which. But it had to go through J&J. Anything coming out of a lab that had any potential to be marketed had to go through J&J first. And then they did the review of it. And that's how we got in with J&J. And it was 96 when you signed. That's when you started Discovery Labs, was 96. And that was... Instead of J&J. They had already given it back to you earlier that year.
Mm.
So that goes way back, Charlie, to like 95 or so, when J&J decided to take it up.
So with that shift in the way that Scripps was working, did this... to this point, it sounded like a traditional academic institution, right? You mentioned also you have people coming in, professors, and people going out, professors, and getting these academic appointments. Once there was this connection to these private companies, did anything change within the institution itself? I mean, now that you have some private companies wanting to opt into potential scientific discoveries, were they also requesting that the money be spent in specific areas over others? Right. Like, I'm just wondering, was it just, or were they just providing a pot of money that Scripps could use, and whatever came out of Scripps, there was the chance that, you know, like J&J, you mentioned.
I can't answer that question. I've not been involved in this. This is a Pete Schultz type question.
Mm-hmm, sure, but. Sure, yeah.
And also along those lines, as your lab grew, how did your role change within that lab? Were you still at the bench alongside everyone else? Once you had more people working with you, were you pulled more away from the bench and now just focused on getting grants? Were there changes for you as the lab grew?
Well, yeah, you can imagine with all the work going on, my having hearing how they were doing, people would come in and say, I got to show you something. And so I would be in my office much more than I was early on, because I wasn't in the office at all. I was always in lab with a pipette in my hand. But that did happen still. I would work in the lab, like I was telling you about the surfactant protein B that I found in the column. That was my getting back at it. So I really did like to keep my head in the lab and work on things, but I couldn't do it nearly as much as I did before the lab grew up to 50 people.
Is that when you hired... When did you hire an administrator for your lab? Was that... Or were you the first one?
Who
was,
admin?
Yeah.
No.
There
had been
from
others.
The start.
Yeah.
Okay. And as it continued to grow...
we had about... How many? Four or three? What?
Well, I was... I was maybe the third or fourth. I don't know how many going back.
Well, I know there were several because I had them doing work, and some of them just all they would do is type out a grant application or a paper that we were submitting for publication. And I would ask them to do something unique, and they just wouldn't do it. So I found somebody who could do anything and unique things as well.
And that was Monica.
That was Monica.
Is your background in science?
No, not at all. That's what I was saying. I was an English major in college. Math and science are not my strong suit.
Sorry.
What she could do was to work out all the things that would be necessary to make everything come together and work in unison.
Here are Richard Lerner's years, 1987 to 2012.
And then Peter Schultz comes
Peter
in
Schultz
at 2012.
Peter Schultz then probably would have been 2012.
Okay.
So
and we weren't there in 2012.
We were not, no. We left in 2005.
Okay.
So it was Richard Lerner. There must have been a crossover because, let's see, then when 88, 89, this science article was 91. Yeah, it would have been Richard Lerner then, you're right, for when we first went with J&J, which was in mid-90s.
Okay.
See, I'm a good admin.
You're good. Google.
She's the one who always knows the answers.
Or where to find it.
It was interesting.
On a broader level, personally, what was going on? I mean, you started at Scripps, you were 30, I think. I know that you eventually get married. What was your life like outside of the lab during this period of time?
You know, one thing is my family, which is probably not significant, having children and that sort of thing, and having to leave one wife, the wife, and then eventually she says, "You finally got it right."
Well, it'd be nice to hear, but I mean, must have put some strain on your relationships, perhaps, when you were working in the lab long hours, or were you? How many children did you have? Were you involved in your children's lives?
Well, yeah, I got along with the children, and vice versa, immensely. That was really great. But then Monica brought everything into my life again. And as you know, we've been all over the world, and like up going to Sweden, and she was the one who sat between two Nobel laureates. And I'm sure they really enjoyed her more than me. But I've become involved in a bunch of other things. One is I went on the board, I was asked to join the board of the Museum of Contemporary Art, which I did. And then I was asked to go into the ResMed Foundation, Respiratory Medicine, and in the foundation, and I became head of philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And we put money into organizations that take kids from in San Diego County who are with very poor families. Yeah. And help get them educated. So there we would review maybe 40 applications and decide which ones should receive the money. And these would then take kids after school who would walk, they're all over the county, mm-hmm. and the kids would walk into their areas and learn science and other various things that helped them with their schooling, and so their grades improved and their desires in life improved, and mm-hmm. it gave them a new life. And that I have the day after tomorrow. We have our annual meeting to decide which. We now had 46 applications coming in, and we only have so much money, which is $250,000 to give out to these organizations, and we have to make hard decisions. Some of them won't get funded, and that's a sad thing. And we've now gotten into another area. It's when these kids from impoverished families get towards the end of high school, they have to decide what they're going to do, and some, without anything to do, they go into gangs and drugs and get incarcerated, and it's a very bad life for them. So we have started a new program, which we call Career Development, and the kids can choose. They can go over a list of things like becoming nurses or carpenters or electricians or whatever, and they chose which areas they would like to get into. And once they do that, then we get them into a community college so they can be trained in those areas and then get a job. And the group that we're working with is the San Diego College of Continuing Education. Mm. We've had meetings with them, and we know the director of it, a guy named
Andre Lucas,
and just a marvelous guy, about 6'2", and he's African-American. So knowledgeable and so generous and so active. And he works out ways of getting them jobs in nursing jobs at Scripps Clinic all over, because we've been meeting with him now several times. And we had a meeting where we brought all of these people who would like to do this work together. And it was on the 23rd.
About a week ago.
Yeah.
And had a marvelous meeting with them. And they will all be getting these. They all have kids in their groups that they will now be showing the areas of the things they might like to do. Mm-hmm. And then they'll take them to the San Diego College of Community and Continuing Education and get them well trained.
Mm-hmm. And these are big organizations here in San Diego, the museums in Balboa mm-hmm. Park that all have an outreach program.
Right, right.
So the total number of kids is about 25,000. And getting them a chance to have a good life that they will lead and they will do is good, makes you feel good.
Absolutely.
So those are the sorts of things we've become involved mm-hmm. in. And we do it together.
Still working together.
You work, because you began working together
January 78.
And then how long did you work together? And at some point you've become romantically involved and married.
Well, like 15 years.
Oh, wow, long time.
Long time.
Yeah. So you've always been, you know, working together mm-hmm. in various ways, and now you're working together in retirement
as well. So it's 46 years.
46 years, yeah.
46 yeah. years.
Yeah.
After I finally got it right.
Right. Nice. Dave, I don't know if you want to scale back at all. One of the things we were talking about was some of, you know, your life outside of the lab and some other stuff. We didn't talk much about this yet, but you were an adjunct professor of pathology at UC San Diego, I think, for quite a while.
Well, they had me giving lectures.
That's what I was wondering. So you did go lecture
in immunology,
as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about that? You know, how many days a week were you lecturing? Did you enjoy lecturing? Did you teach labs too?
One lecture per year.
Oh, that's all. Okay, so it wasn't... Okay.
And there would be a new group of young people that would come in the next year, so I'd give them a lecture.
I see. Did you build any relationships out of that? Did they come work in your lab at all? Or
Chuck Parkos?
Yeah, we had one fellow who came over to... work at the lab.
Okay.
And you want to see a picture of him?
Did he come back? He's now the head of...
University of Michigan.
The head of one of the departments that Roger Wiggins, who had also been in the lab,
okay.
He took over that chairmanship from an individual who had been in the lab, too.
Peter Ward is there,
too. Peter Ward.
Yeah.
Well, Roger Wiggins, too. Did he take over from... Yeah, he took over from Peter Ward.
Yeah.
Roger Wiggins was there, too.
And these are postdocs who go out and become well-known and leading scientists and administrators, heads of departments. I was asked to become the chairman of about 30 departments around the country.
Oh, really? Okay.
Which I wouldn't do it, because if you become chairman of a department, you know how much you need to concentrate on the vacation time and the salaries that all the people in the administrative part of things need, and you never set foot in a lab.
Right. You mentioned in passing earlier about, we were in Europe then. Could you tell me a bit, where did you go in Europe and how frequently, why? You've traveled the world as a few things. Could you talk a little bit about those experiences?
Well,
first of all, scientists are invited to give talks in beautiful places in the world.
Yeah, like in Poland.
Yeah, he was invited to give a talk in Poland, thankfully, in English.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also,
in London and...
Yeah, Switzerland, everywhere, Austria.
Yeah.
But did you spend time living abroad as well?
We did.
Could you tell me about that a little
bit? This was after we stopped our research.
It was after research.
But the first couple of years, actually, were while we were still working. And then also, once we retired, the work did not stop. It just morphed into something else.
And this was Italy?
This was Italy, Florence, Italy. And we lived 3 months of the year in Florence for 10 years.
Did you have access to a lab while you were out there?
No.
So what kind of work did you do?
Before the days of the iPad, which made it even harder, but we rented a computer every year that we had in the apartment, and I knew it was the same computer because it had all of my same programs on it.
Where did you rent a computer from?
Through the people who we rented the apartment from. It was a wonderful relationship. They were, the apartments and the rental agency were owned by the Ferragamos.
Oh.
You may not know who that is, Dave.
Yeah, go tell us.
Ferragamo is one of the top designers in the world. They are headquartered, actually, in Florence. And so they owned like 60 or 70 apartments.
Designers of?
Shoes, but clothing as well. They have you may know this, they have a wonderful museum on the top floor of this palazzo.
It's
the history of the Ferragamo shoes. But they owned the apartments as well as the rental agency, and we became very good friends.
Okay.
Not with the Ferragamos, unfortunately, but the people in the agency.
Okay.
It was great, and they did so much for us. Every year, we packed up all of our things. It was a fully furnished apartment, but if you see all the dishes that are in there, all Italian
whole bunch of
ceramics
from the Italian Renaissance.
Yeah.
We have collected all these books that we were reading there, and they would take them down.
Into the cantina.
Yeah, and then bring them back up when we'd come, before we would come.
And including my desk, my work desk.
Oh, wow.
And the computer didn't stay when we weren't here, but the desk did. And that was wonderful because there wouldn't have been anything else in the apartment for me to do the work.
So at this time you are able to work remotely then.
Yes, and it was before the days of iPhone, iPad. This
Gosh.
Would have made it so much easier.
Sure.
But for traveling, we traveled while we were there, and... I found I could just go to a little tiny internet cafe, mm-hmm. which you've surely seen there. And it's very enterprising. Mm-hmm. A restaurant would have, or a bar, a cafe, one computer, one printer, but that's all you need.
Yeah.
And the kids that are studying there or traveling there all go to check their emails
right.
and do work. And it was great. It worked. We also happened to have had a computer, more than that, an internet cafe itself
right
across the street. So if I ever had a problem with the computer, I just went across. But if we were traveling, all it would need is one.
Right.
It's very clever.
But from all that, I got so interested in the Italian Renaissance that I put a book together on it. I have it in the other room.
So you've published on the Italian Renaissance? What did you publish?
It was self-publishing.
Yeah, what was that?
I'll have to...
I can get it.
Well, while she's grabbing it, is this about the art of the Italian Renaissance?
Yeah. About the art of the Italian. And why it was so important, because up till that point, everything was under the Catholic Church and the Pope. And the Pope said that everything can be in just two dimensions, one dimension, and they have to be religious forms. So there was a mother and child or Jesus or whatever. But then along came a guy named Giotto in 1310, and he did something different, which was slightly different. And then the people following Giotto did more and more of that.
Thank you. Significant Artistic Creativity in the Italian Renaissance by Charles G. Cochran. It's a self-published book that he did in 2015.
To show him, huh?
Yeah.
Nice.
So you got into the Italian Renaissance? This is something you're doing on the side of science, or it's something you got into in retirement?
Sort of, well, both.
Both.
Well, Rick, in 1952, his brother, when you went and spent 2 months with Rick in Florence.
That's when I first saw it, yeah.
This is your brother who went to Yale,
yes.
Did his bachelor's in history.
Right. Yeah, he was a Fulbright scholar.
And he went on a Fulbright scholar over there in Florence, working on an area that was very little known about it, which was post-Renaissance and pre-modern. Mm-hmm. And he... wrote books on that. Got his PhD, and I went over to be with him in 1952 in the summer. I usually would go home, as we talked about,
right.
in Berkeley. But my parents said, why don't you go and be with your brother in 1952, and which I did. And he taught me all sorts of things about, like the language and words not to use, and can I give you one example?
Please do.
Charlie always used the plural for keys, which is chiave, because if you say chiava, it means he fucks.
Does it? I didn't know
that one. I looked it up in the dictionary, and that's exactly what it is.
I'm assuming you speak a fluent Italian.
A dialect. Dave has some too.
Yeah. Caruso.
Yeah.
Did you learn that word too?
No, I mean, I haven't been exposed to that family for a long time, so it was when I was young, and it was just, you know, the angry conversations that would happen.
But you learned to say chiave?
Yeah, I heard it. Wasn't allowed to repeat it.
Yeah. He's not either.
So you have... Did you... French and Italian then? Or some of the languages you spoke?
Well, not really. I tried Italian, but I must say that... Since it wasn't something we spoke constantly.
Sure.
The other thing I would do is I'd try to speak Italian, and I would plug French words in instead of Italian words.
Right.
The funny thing is that, I guess it's not funny, they all understood it because it's all Romance based on the Latin.
Yeah. Well, Dave, do you want to jump in with anything else, or?
I don't think I have anything else.
Should we ask if there's anything that we didn't cover so far that you'd like to have covered in this? Anything that you're like, oh, geez, there was that story that I didn't get a chance to work into this conversation yet?
I think you've got a good coverage, and I was interviewed by the Research Institute, and they went through all of these things. Did I send you this?
Yeah, you have that.
So you've seen all of this.
Yeah, so we're trying to cover some different ground today.
Yeah.
Dave, anything then that you thought of that we didn't cover?
No.
Okay, well, great. Guess we'll conclude by thanking you and Monica for your time with us today.
It was a pleasure. It's fun to think about your life.
I'm going to turn off the recorder now. Monica, we were just wrapping up. Was there any, before I turn this off, we were wrapping up and asking if there's any stories that we may have missed that you want to make sure you get into the record.
For the whole...
No, and we can always ask you again later if there's something as you're reviewing this, but just as we're turning it off, if there was something you were like, oh, geez.
I think you pretty much covered everything, didn't you? But as you say, if he thinks of something,
do it later.
I'll add it in the editing.
Okay.